what we see is that ADHD, autism, and all of the other neurobehavioral disorders like dyslexia, OCD, learning disabilities, processing disorders, they're all actually increasing at the exact same rate.
That's Dr. Robert Melillo talking about his book, Disconnected Kids. It's about his innovative approach to treating children with neurodevelopmental problems.
The treatment for ADD, and again, I don't like to call it treatment so much as sort of helping people learn to develop their gifts, but part of helping people learn to develop their gifts is learning how to perform these executive functions more effectively.
And that's ADHD expert Dr. Ned Hallowell. Later, we'll hear a 2006 interview with him about his book, Delivered from Distraction. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Bill Bowie, in for Francesca Rhiannon. Learning disabilities, autism, ADD, and other neurodevelopmental disorders are skyrocketing in children, with an estimated 1.5 million more children diagnosed each year. The cause is controversial. Some say these disorders are just getting diagnosed more than in the past. Others say diagnosis is being pushed by drug companies wanting to sell more of their products. And still others point to the hectic pace of modern life and understaffed schools to say that society's out of whack, not kids. But those who suffer the burdens of these disorders say they're real. Whether they're parents who see their kids struggling to make friends and make sense of their homework, or adults who leave a long trail of lost jobs and failed relationships. All this in spite of being very bright, creative, and open-hearted. Drugs can help, but they can also have dangerous side effects, including heart attacks and seizures. Many parents of children with neurodevelopmental disorders, as well as adults who have them, are looking for alternative or complementary treatments. Dr. Robert Melillo is a neurological chiropractor who's developed a system for treating these disorders using exercises to train the brain. He says the problem lies in a failure of both sides of the brain to smoothly communicate with each other, and that his approach can strengthen areas of the brain that are weakest. He lays out his method in a new book, Disconnected Kids, the groundbreaking brain balance program for children with autism, ADHD, dyslexia, and other neurological disorders.
Dr. Robert Melillo, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Your book, Disconnected Kids, is about a brain balance program that you developed to help kids with a whole variety of what are called neurological conditions, autism, ADD, pervasive developmental disorders, Asperger's. You say these disorders are an epidemic.
Yeah, well, we know these statistics are staggering. I mean, you know, I don't know if your audience is aware of it, but, you know, autism, for example, about 10 years ago, was approximately diagnosed 1 in 10,000 children born in the United States. It was considered a relatively rare disorder. And now, as of the most recent CDC statistics, which are actually really not very recent because they're really from 2004, it's 1 in 150 in the United States. But actually, it's believed to be probably closer or even worse than the statistics that just came out of Cambridge, England last year, which puts the UK prevalence at 1 in 58. ADHD is the leading childhood disorder in the world of any kind. It's the number one reason why a child will be medicated. And worldwide use of medication for ADHD has tripled in the last 10 years. So what we see is that ADHD, autism, and all of the other neurobehavioral disorders like dyslexia, OCD, learning disabilities, processing disorders, they're all actually increasing at the exact same rate. So although autism gets the most attention right now, it's not increasing any faster than anything else. So
now, hold on for a second. You're saying they're all increasing at the same rate precisely?
Yes.
And where did you find the figures for that?
There was a study out of Denmark last year, 2007 actually, that looked at ADHD, OCD, and Tourette syndrome and showed that the prevalence worldwide was increasing at the exact same rate as autism. And there are a number of other studies around that show that, you know, the comorbidity of these things is very, very high, which means that...
And you should explain what that means for our audience.
It means that most children that have one label, 50% of them have at least one other label, so that most of these diagnoses or labels come in groups, come in clusters. So what we see is that all of these disorders are increasing at about the same rate, and the thinking is that because basically they all have the same underlying problem, the same area of the brain is involved. So when we look at that rise, you have to look at that and say this is an epidemic rise because it's been happening only over the past two decades, and that it is a real rise. I mean, most current research shows that this isn't just because we're better at recognizing these things or that we're substituting labels. There was a study just came out of Cal Berkeley last week looking at California statistics, and it showed that there's no way you could describe the full increase in that state just by diagnostic substitution, that it represented a real increase in these disorders.
And you cite a figure that one out of every six kindergartners will be diagnosed with one of these neurological disorders. What are some of the causes that you're looking at that you think are creating this epidemic rise?
Well, first of all, when you recognize it as an epidemic, which it is, you have to look at it and say, well, there's no such thing as a genetic epidemic. So it can't be purely a genetic cause, because you don't see a genetic disorder all of a sudden explode off the board. It just doesn't happen that way. You would, in fact, as a matter of fact, if you look at something like autism, if it was in fact truly a genetic disorder, as we think of genetic disorders, meaning that, you know, two parents get together, one of them or both of them has a bad gene, it comes out, and the child gets the disorder the majority of the time. If that was the case, then autism actually should be declining in prevalence, because the vast majority of people that have autism don't actually have children. Yeah. So that's one thing that tells us that you shouldn't see such a rapid, dramatic increase over a period of time. That's not the way genetic disorders work. They will increase gradually over time if they do. They don't just suddenly increase over a period of two decades, seeing, you know, 1,000% increase.
Okay, so what is causing this rise?
What you look at is that what we call epigenetic influences. That's the new buzzword in genetics. What does that mean? It means that, you know, there are genes involved here, of course, and there seems to be that these disorders seem to run in families at a higher rate, so they seem to be inherited. That's why we commonly think of them as genetic. But what that means is that there are environmental factors that will turn off or turn on segments of genes at the wrong time.
So is this kind of like the idea that genes may be there, but you need a trigger, something that will fire the trigger?
Yeah, exactly. So what we see is that the majority of genes we have, 80% of the genes we have, are there to build our brain. And they're meant to be very adaptable. They allow our brain to adapt to any environment that we grow in. That's what makes the human brain the most unique brain of all. But it also makes those genes very susceptible to environmental influences. And if there are negative environmental influences, it can impact or turn off certain segments of the gene. But this is the important thing about this, is that when you recognize that these problems are not genetic and that they're primarily epigenetic or being driven by environment, you now have a whole difference, whereas before many parents are told that these problems are incurable or uncorrectable because they're genetic. Now you realize that, well, that's not true, that they now fall into the realm of the possibility of actually being cured or corrected because they're mostly environmentally based, and those genes can be turned back on or turned back off.
Well, let me ask you then, if these are environmentally caused, and some people have pointed to, for example, the ubiquitous chemicals that we have, the estrogenic chemicals, as possible causes, not for autism, I've heard, but certainly for learning disabilities and ADHD, things that we consume, PCBs and things of that kind, how can we turn them off if they're in our environment and we're exposed to them?
Well, the first thing is identifying what, in fact, is actually causing them, right? So that once we actually look at and say, if there are environmental factors such as toxins that are one of the potential issues, then once we identify that, then we could eliminate those chemicals from our environment or at least limit our exposure to that. But, you know, when we look at toxins in our environment, although those may be one of the factors that may be contributing in some ways, it probably isn't the major cause, because when you look at toxins that affect a child, let's say, developing brain, for the most part, we can all understand how a toxin would make areas of the brain function less. But what you can't understand is how can a toxin make areas of the brain function better than normal at possibly even superhuman levels, as we see in savant syndrome. And one of the things that stands out with all of these children is that they don't have functions that are all bad. They have certain functions that are below their age level, but they have other functions that are usually superior, well above their age level. So if it was just a toxin in our environment, you know, it's kind of hard to understand how it would actually enhance brain function.
Unless the brain compensates, in fact, it shuts off certain things that the toxin attacks, leaving the brain to overdevelop in other areas.
It's possible that, you know, it may actually shut down certain areas, and then obviously that may enhance processing in other areas. But, you know, if it was truly a toxin and it affected one area of the brain, why wouldn't it affect the other area of the brain if it's disseminated through the bloodstream and it goes everywhere equally?
You may be right. On the other hand, certain chemicals log on to certain, you know, the estrogens, for example, estrogenic chemicals go to certain receptors.
Mm-hmm. Those are good questions. And the idea is that, you know, these are the questions that we need to ask. And these are the questions that come about when you realize that there are environmental factors. Now we start discussions about how it could happen, what specific factors, and what can we do about it, rather than just sit back and hope that someday we'll have a way of gene splicing.
Now, one of the things or causes that you point to in your book, and I'm talking with Dr. Robert Melillo, his book is Disconnected Kids, the Groundbreaking Brain Balance Program for Children with Autism, ADHD, Dyslexia, and Other Neurological Disorders. One of the causes you point out is kids being too sedentary.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest single cause, actually.
How so?
First of all, what you need to do is go back and say, why do we have brains to begin with? And we have brains because we move. You know, the reason why plants don't have nervous system and brains is because they don't move. Once we started to move, we needed brains to guide our movement. So motor activity, movement, is what causes us to have brains. And in children, it's what develops their brain. Children's brains initially form and develop not based on cognitive stimulation, because they don't have a brain yet. The way that the foundation of the brain forms is through movement and through interacting with our senses, with the environment. And then that input comes back into our brain and causes it to grow and develop, which forms the foundation of the networks that will later on be built to develop cognitive and academic and social and emotional skills and development. So that, for instance, learning how to crawl around a room and learning how to pull yourself up and learning how to, you know, run outside and climb a tree, those form the networks that will later on be used to understand things like spatial math, like geometry. And so if a child doesn't develop the ability to do geometry, it's not necessarily because, you know, they haven't had enough exposure to it, but rather the networks that allow them to understand that weren't built in childhood because they didn't move enough.
So this leads to your theory. You actually group all these disorders together in what you call functional disconnection syndrome, and we'll call it FDS. And you say it's a problem of a disconnect between the right and the left brain.
Yeah, and I'm not the only one that's saying this at this point. There's, you know, a lot of people out there, including people like Martha Herbert out of Harvard and Marcel Just and Dan Geschman out of UCLA, other people, you know, top researchers that are saying that these problems are all basically the same problem and that they're due to some form of functional disconnection.
What does it mean to be functionally disconnected?
What it means is that areas of the brain, normally the brain needs to communicate with the whole brain, so that when we have an idea, a thought, a memory, when we learn something, basically different areas of the brain, visual areas, auditory areas, thought areas, emotional areas, they all fire at the same time, and then they are linked together. And that pattern of electrical activity, those cells that are all lit up together, that pattern becomes a memory or a thought. And there really is not a lot of room for mistake there, meaning like nanoseconds they have to fire. And what we see is that in a functional disconnection, areas of the brain can't get online at the same time. And so what happens is they can't be bound together into a single thought. Certain things are get there faster. And so there's a communication deficit where areas of the brain can't communicate and share information, so that children with this problem, they can't ever really use their whole brain at the same time. They use certain areas well, and other areas they don't use, and the areas that they use well get stronger and stronger, and the areas that they don't use get weaker and weaker. And because of that, the communication gets broken down, and they don't form a lot of physical connections between those areas of the brain.
Well, let's go a little bit deeper into this idea. First of all, you say it's a disconnect between right and left brain. You've got a lot of different conditions brought under one roof here under this functional disconnection syndrome. For example, you say that Asperger's and ADD are brought under them, and they do share some symptoms, but they're all really vastly different. I have ADD, and so does my son. And I know that ADD people like us are often very big picture people, while people with Asperger's are extremely detail oriented and really obsessive, and almost the opposite. So how does it work? You put them both under the kind of the right brain delay.
Well, actually what happens is a lot of people are mislabeled as ADHD or ADD, because it's really just a group of symptoms, and it kind of depends on how you put them together. Actually, people with true ADHD, which is, you know, widely recognized as a deficiency in the right side of the brain, especially the right frontal lobe, are not big picture people. They're actually, just like autistics and Asperger's, they're very focused on detail. What happens is you get a lot of people who actually really are the opposite, where their left brain is deficient and their right brain is very, very strong. Those are big picture skill people, and those are people that typically have more dyslexia, reading disorders, and learning disabilities that are misdiagnosed as ADHD because they are, you know, also the right brain. When your right brain is strong, you get bored really fast. You want new things all the time, and you're very spatial. Also, children may not really understand what's actually on the board or what's really going on in class. So they may, you know, not pay attention, or they may be daydreaming, you know, or you may also show attentional issues right around school time or homework time as a way of avoiding schoolwork.
I guess this is where I've really found your book very valuable and interesting, but I took the tests that were in it, and I have some questions about how this right brain and left brain stuff works, because I found that I was very, very strong in both right brain and left brain things, very weak in right brain and left brain things. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed Dr. Ned Hallowell, who is one of the leading researchers on ADHD, particularly in adults, and he definitely talks about the strong big picture component that people with ADD have, the tremendous creativity that a lot of people with ADD have. These are all kind of right brain things. And yet, as you can see, I do a book show. I'm strong on language. That's left brain. So I guess I wonder, how important is it to really, I mean, isn't everybody's brain pretty much different? And is it really important to try to shunt one to one side or the other? What is the kernel here of your method, and does it really depend on this kind of schema of right and left brain?
Yeah, well, one of the things I think is that the reason for the way I look at it is I'm looking at it from a neurological perspective, and that's where I think that someone like Ned Hallowell or other people, they don't. They look at it from a symptomatic standpoint, not really necessarily understanding or looking at it from what's actually happening in the brain. And to me, the label doesn't really matter. I've seen so many people that I think are mislabeled as ADHD and maybe actually a learning disability or vice versa, and the label doesn't really matter. To me, what matters is what's happening in the brain, because I don't really care about a grouping of symptoms. I care about function. I care about what's happening and what parts of the brain are functioning and not functioning. And what we do see is that people that have these labels typically are unusually talented in certain areas, and in other areas they have great difficulty. That's the point. The point that they have an unevenness of skills, which is characteristic. Now, no one's really been able to fully understand why that is the case. My concept actually does explain it very well. What you have to realize, though, is that although we're generalizing right brain, left brain, it's really that there are areas even within the brain, within one side of the brain, that are going to function better than others. So that, you know, overall, we may see that the right brain is weaker and the left brain is stronger, but within the right brain, there are going to be areas that are stronger than others.
I see.
And we all have certain abilities. If you take anybody, they're going to have certain things that they're good at left brain, certain things right brain. But when you put all of this stuff together, when you put all of the information together, it comes out pretty clear that this is in fact what's going on. And that if you look at it and really look at the research and really look at, you know, neuropsychology and measuring what people do well and what people do poorly, then you start to see that this model really works very, very well.
And I'm talking with Dr. Robert Melillo about his book, Disconnected Kids. So you have this, you have a symptom checklist, but you also have a home-based program that can teach parents actually how to assess what is strong, what is weak in their kids, and how to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you saying basically that irrespective of the label, that people can identify and then treat what are the areas of the brain, whether it may be some parts of right brain and some parts of left brain, they can treat them and get them stronger so the brain is more balanced?
Exactly. Meaning that what we're doing is teaching parents what we've been using in our centers for years. Doesn't necessarily replace the sophistication of what we do in the centers, but we've seen that parents have gotten great results just using the home program. And the idea is to get a parent to, first of all, understand these concepts, and then to look at their children and see things in the sensory and in the motor realm, measure things like the child's hearing and vision and light sensitivity and auditory processing and visual processing skills and gross motor, fine motor, posture, balance. And by looking at things that are simple, like, for instance, you look at a child and their head tilts to the right. Does that mean anything? Well, in and by itself, it may not. But more often than not, when you see that with one pupil that's larger than the other, and they don't hear as well out of one ear as the other, and they don't really feel the left side of their body as well as the right side of their body, you know, now you put that all together and it starts to tell you something. It starts to tell you that there's a neurological imbalance. And then when you look at that, then you say, okay, these are the functions of my child that are weak. These are the functions that are strong. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at that and I'm going to do exercises that have been shown to be able to strengthen those functions that are weak.
Could you give an example of an exercise, of a function that's weak and an exercise that could strengthen it?
Sure. We look at something like dichotic listening, meaning that we look to see, you know, if you're able to hear things simultaneously in both ears at the same time. Children that have attentional problems, especially right-sided problems, what's going to happen is typically their right ear is going to be much stronger than their left, that their attention is drawn to their right ear, and they can't really pay as much attention to the left ear at the same time. Whereas the average person and the average child, if you play two words or put two sounds, they'll hear it at the same time in both ears. And then what we can do is do an exercise where we have them pay attention only to one ear, or we will block sound from the good ear and play music in the bad ear.
And does this have to be maintained throughout their life, or is it once it's learned, it's there?
The way the brain works is just like exercising a muscle. And when we look at these children, what we see is that these areas, these networks in the brain that are underactive and that are underdeveloped are not broken, they're not damaged, they're just underdeveloped because they appear to be underused and therefore they're immature. Just like if you didn't use your right arm and you just use your left arm all the time. You may be really good at using your left arm and your right arm may not be really good at all. It doesn't mean that you can't change that. It doesn't mean that through training you can't build those muscles up and build that function up to where it matches the other side. And then what you do, you don't have to keep on doing those exercises. It'll just stay there with natural activity. And that's really what's happening. When we strengthen these networks, these areas of the brain that are weaker, and they grow and the cells get larger, and now they start to connect with other areas of the brain, that natural activity and that natural sharing of information will keep them there.
How did you actually develop this program? You're a doctor of chiropractic, is that correct?
I have multiple degrees. I have a degree in chiropractic neurology. I have a master's in neuroscience. I'm also presently completing my PhD in neuropsychology rehabilitation. I also am a professor of neuroanatomy at a university level. I'm also a professor of clinical neurology. So I have multiple areas of interest.
Okay, so how did you develop it? What did this come out of? Did it come out of your clinical practice, or did it come out of your theoretical work? How did you arrive with these particular exercises to strengthen these weaknesses that you were able to identify?
It came out of both. When I was early on in my career, I completed my diplomate in neurology, and I trained with a Dr. Ted Carrick, who is also a chiropractic neurologist and also is a PhD in education, and he is just a brilliant individual, a good friend of mine. And I started teaching on an academic level rehabilitation and neurology, and I also was always involved in neurology and rehabilitation. That was my focus. And I also always worked with a multi-specialty team, meaning I always worked with MDs and psychologists and nutritionists and, you know, all different types of specialists, working with severe neurological problems, not just pain or dizziness or headaches, but also head injury and strokes and things of that nature. And I was involved academically with teaching clinical neurology, and one of the things that the concept that Dr. Carrick had developed was this concept of hemisphericity, meaning that there was this hemispheric imbalance that seemed to be underlying a number of different disorders and neurological problems. So I started to work with adults using that in a rehab model and really was getting fantastic results. But then somebody approached me around 1994, 1995 to look into some research into things with ADHD and childhood disorders. And my children were very young. My oldest child was 6 years old at the time, 5, 6 years old. And as I started looking into the research, I was shocked to see that the use of Ritalin in the United States from 1990 to 95 had increased 250%. And that was one of the first statistics that kind of grabbed everybody's attention to say, what the heck's going on here? And so as I started looking into it more, I started becoming more and more aware of it, and I also started to recognize some of these symptoms in my oldest child. So it became something that became very personal to me as a young parent and wanting to know what was happening and why was this happening and how could it potentially affect my child and what could I do to help him. And that's really where it started.
You know, one of the questions I think for a lot of us who have this kind of experience of, you know, having ADD or thinking about it is, you know, we understand that there's something real that's going on here. But as you point out, the Ritalin has increased tremendously, and many people ask whether these are diagnoses that are being pushed by a combination of pharmaceutical companies and teachers who don't want to deal with kids who are having behavior problems, you know, classrooms that have too many kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things that people will typically say to try to explain the statistical increase, because they're so staggering that we almost, you know, can't believe them. So we have to believe that there's some other reason for it. But if you spent as much time as I do really speaking with teachers and principals and people in the education community, they will tell you that these are real problems, that this isn't just, you know, bad kids and we have more bratty kids and we have worse parents and we have doctors just trying to push off medication, you know, for bad parenting. that is actually untrue. And if you look at special education programs, for instance, across the country, they're exploding and they're overwhelmed. And the fact is, it's become harder and harder to get a special ed certification because school districts can't afford it anymore. But yet, to get that certification, you have to have some sort of documented disability, learning disability, because it's not just enough to get, you know, a behavioral label. So what we see is that there are more documented cases of problems, and that it's not just improved recognition. It's not just, you know, that we're just handing out medication haphazardly. That's probably some of the rise. Without a doubt, you know, there was some changing diagnostic criteria. That accounts for some of it, but certainly not the vast majority of it. These are real problems, and we need to recognize that, because until we do, you know, the first way to stop an epidemic is really through, you know, awareness and recognition.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Melillo about his Brain Balance program for treating neurodevelopmental disorders like ADD and Asperger's syndrome. We'll talk more after a break.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Dr. Robert Melillo. He's the creator and founder of Brain Balance Centers. His book is Disconnected Kids. Now, another issue that comes up is that there are many people who have ADHD or ADD, who have Asperger's syndrome, who have said, in fact, that their brains are not disabled, thank you very much. They work very well, they're very happy with them, and that their brains are just different and not disabled.
Absolutely. And you know, you can go and we can look at a lot of people that are out there that are functioning at very high levels and that could probably be on the cusp of Asperger's. Bill Gates, for example. But, you know, I heard a great thing the other day. I was just in Kansas City, and I was just doing a lecture and promotion down there. And one of the mothers of a child with Asperger's said that an uncle had said something when he was very young about the child, and she always remembered it. And he said, you know, don't worry. People like him are the ones that get us to the moon. And it's actually true. I mean, when you look at geniuses, when you look at these genius-level skills that move society to a different level. Throughout history, you look at Isaac Newton, you look at Mozart.
Einstein.
What?
Einstein.
Einstein, yeah. Einstein was probably more of a right brain genius, like you describe yourself, actually. He was probably
I don't
more
know that a, I would put genius on.
Well, when you talk about big picture skills, yeah. Nobody had a better big picture skill than Albert Einstein.
That's for sure.
But he was very social, and he was actually very personable, whereas somebody like Isaac Newton was considered a jerk by everybody because he was so abrasive and so direct, and you know, that's the classic Asperger's person. I mean, when you read anything on Mozart, he was clearly an autistic savant. You know, so they are the people that will move us to a certain point. And you know, but if they have such painful social skills, many of these people are so brilliant. But I've talked to them, and they talk about how painful it is that they've not been able to have a date or that they can't relate to other people. And, you know, so when it gets to that point, then they may need help. But other than that, if they don't, then absolutely, it may not be disability. It may be considered a gift.
Well, here's a question then. It's always been my intuition that these disabilities do go hand in hand with these gifts, with creative gifts or whatever the gifts may be.
Absolutely.
I have a young friend, the son of a friend of mine, who is very gifted athletically, but certainly has great learning disabilities in other areas. I've often wondered if they...
Which is classic of a left brain deficit, by the way.
Okay. And I've wondered if the disability, the gift, go together, and then Then what happens if you treat them? Kids on Ritalin often will complain that their creativity is gone. What if you treat them in the way that your program, your Brain Balance program, treats them? Are you going to wash out the gifts that they have?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The fact is, I say it all the time, and I say it in the book, that what we see is that the people that have these disabilities, what's happened is that they have these natural genetic gifts, meaning they're born with these, you know, with a strong left brain skills or strong right brain skills. And where normally we all would see, you know, we're more left brain or we're more right brain, but these people have, you know, unusual gifts and unusual skills. And they're kind of on a precipice, because if you now throw certain environmental factors together and you tweak these genes the wrong way, this gift quickly becomes a curse to these people in some cases, where now it just gets unbalanced, you know, where somebody might be, you know, typically very good left brain person who isn't really great socially, a little bit of a wallflower, but they're, you know, an engineer and they're brilliant and they're brilliant computer scientist. You take that same person and you tweak their genes a little bit because of lack of physical activity or lack of human interaction or lack of a vitamin or too much stress. And what happens is all of a sudden the imbalance becomes so much that now it becomes a disability. And what we've seen, first of all, medication doesn't address the underlying problem. And so what happens is you find kids that will say, I feel like I lost myself. But what we see with the Brain Balance program is we don't lower the strong side, we just raise the weak side. So, for instance, we get a child who may have initially an IQ where their verbal skills are 140 and their nonverbal skills are 70 or 80. And then what we do is we typically bring the nonverbal skills up to that 140 level and match them. And so we actually enhance their weaknesses. That's what we work on.
Okay, and here is now the $64,000 question, which is, could this also work with adults?
Absolutely. I mean, I spent a large part of my career, the first half of my career, really, you know, exclusively working with adults and doing these principles. And without a doubt, it works. It is a little different. But when we see things like anxiety disorders and depression, for instance, depression is generally decreased activation of the left side of the brain and the left frontal lobe. Anxiety disorders are the opposite. And along with when we look at things like schizophrenia and other disorders like that, bipolar disorder, it seems like they are the same, they're in the same spectrum. Many researchers consider that schizophrenia and drug addiction is in the same spectrum as these other disorders. And so, yes, it will work. It just takes a different approach, but it's the same basic principles at play here. And, you know, but there is, children's brains are not mini adult brains. They're, you know, they require a different approach to development.
What are some of the differences?
Well, the differences are that with adults, you can use more cognitive-based activities. You know, with adults, because they have a fully developed brain, using mental exercises, things like biofeedback, meditation, using more cognitive stimulation, and using more varied type things. Like, you wouldn't necessarily use academic exercises, but rather what we call cognitive skills. That's something that will work better on adults than it does with children, because with children, they haven't really formed that cognitive part of their brain yet. So that's why, you know, you get a person with a learning disability or dyslexia as a child, and you sit them down and you force them to read over and over and over. It doesn't work. It doesn't make them any better, because that part of their brain isn't there yet. But with an adult, you can do that if they've acquired the underlying, like if it was something that acquired later on in life, you know, something that developed for various reasons, and the foundation was already built. And so the types of cognitive activities and how you do it and how much of that you would do. Also, you know, some of the physical-based activities might be slightly different as well. So, you know, those are really where a lot of the differences come into play.
So, Dr. Robert Melillo, you're really saying that the brain is plastic, not just for children, but for adults as well. It can change and it can be strengthened. Our genetics isn't destiny.
Absolutely. And that is basically everywhere in the scientific research right now. As a matter of fact, the cover of Discover magazine in 2006 and Scientific American in the same month said that very thing. It says DNA is not destiny. And, you know, neuroplasticity is all over the scientific literature. And every year we find out through research that the brain is even more plastic than we ever imagined. You know, we used to think it was only in children. Now we realize that even up till the day you die, your brain is incredibly changeable and plastic, even with severe disorders, neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's. You can still change the brain and improve it.
Dr. Robert Melillo's book is Disconnected Kids, the Groundbreaking Brain Balance Program for Children with Autism, ADHD, Dyslexia, and Other Neurological Disorders. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Your questions were great.
You can find a link to Melillo's Brain Balance Centers by going to writersvoice.net.
As you heard in Francesca's conversation with Robert Melillo, one way of approaching ADD, Asperger's, and other conditions like them is to see them as disorders based on the relative strength or weakness of the two sides of the brain. Another way is to look at how different people behave, their symptoms. That's the approach taken by ADD expert Ned Hollowell. He also thinks ADD isn't so much a disorder as a difference. A different style of brain functioning with strengths and weaknesses. Hollowell is the author of several acclaimed books aimed at helping adults with ADD find ways to compensate for their weaknesses and celebrate their strengths. Among other books, he wrote the groundbreaking Driven by Distraction. Francesca talked with him about its sequel, Delivered from Distraction, in 2006. Hollowell says ADD shows up in different ways in different people.
You're better just talking about, you know, what are your symptoms? What are the issues that bless your life and what are the issues that curse your life, you know, and not sort of talk about, well, ADD as if it were, you know, you have to match the textbook kind of thing. What you really want to talk about is yourself or your child, you know, and what are the issues that are getting in his way or her way? And what are the issues that are wonderful and you want to preserve and develop?
Well, you know, one of the things that I like so much about your work is that you do emphasize both the gifts as well as some of the drawbacks of it. And you say that the best way to think of ADD is not as a mental disorder, but as a collection of traits and tendencies that define a way of being in the world. So how do you draw the line between disability and difference?
Well, you see, I think the whole disability model, the whole pathology model, is a really bad one when it comes to dealing with the mind, because when you put a person in that realm of disability, you create a far worse condition called shame and fear than the one you're trying to remediate. So I think it's really very important to start by saying, well, what are your strengths? What are your talents? What are your interests? What are your potential strengths? What would you like to get better at? And then say, okay, what gets in the way? You see, and if you make the strength the headline, and then you say what gets in the way is sort of second paragraph, that casts a whole different light on the issue. It says, look, you've got all these great things going for you, and now what are we going to do to develop them? And in order to develop them, well, we have to learn how to get better organized, or we have to learn how to pay attention more consistently, or we have to learn how to be on time and not procrastinate chronically. But by putting it all in the service of the strengths, the development of strengths, you don't induce the problem of shame and fear and depression and lowered self-esteem and all that kind of stuff that so often gets created when people go to visit mental health professionals.
And actually can make the problem worse.
Oh, always does. And it's and what's insidious is it's never acknowledged. You say, oh, thank you very much, doctor, for giving me this wonderful report that delineates in fine detail all my weaknesses.
Right.
You know, and indeed the doctor is doing his best to help you. Mm-hmm. But the model is a very damaging one.
You know, understanding, of course, that everybody's different, but maybe you can talk a little bit about what are some of the gifts or the strengths of the ADD brain in general.
Absolutely. I mean, these folks are usually highly creative, original. They really live by intuition. They often have a very zany sense of humor, very much able to come up with different approaches. For example, the man who invented the electronic ticket that we all use in air travel now has ADD. And when he thought of that idea, everyone laughed at him and said, "Don't be absurd. No one will go to the airport without a paper ticket." Now we all do. His name is David Neeleman. He's the CEO of JetBlue Airlines. And energy, usually very warm, very engaging when they're paying attention. Just a tremendous sort of joie de vivre, again, as long as they haven't been beaten down. Those are all qualities that you can't buy. You can't train. And so it's a great gift. Then you just want to take care of the problems that can get in the way.
Now let's turn to the other side of that, and let's talk about some of the disadvantages. You talk about something called executive function.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what is executive function and why is that an issue with people who have ADD?
Well, executive function just is sort of a fancy term for anything that relates to getting organized, planning what you want to do next, prioritizing, anticipating, time management, all of these sort of decision-making issues, hence the term executive. This is where folks with ADD tend to be vulnerable. At times they can do it very well, but at other times when they're not focused, they don't do it very well. And so they forget and they overlook and they show up at the wrong date in the wrong place in the wrong time. And if you do that chronically, you can underachieve.
You can burn a lot of bridges, actually.
Yes, you can also burn a lot of bridges. So the treatment for ADD, and again, I don't like to call it treatment so much as sort of helping people learn to develop their gifts, but part of helping people learn to develop their gifts is learning how to perform these executive functions more effectively.
Could you give an example?
Sure. In my own life, I used to chronically lose my car keys until I finally trained myself to always put them in the same place every day, right in a box I put right next to my front door. And that made a big difference. For someone else, it might be getting the right kind of daytime planner. For someone else, it's buying a book on organization and actually implementing some of the tips in it. For someone else, it's delegating. It's hiring someone to do it for you, a secretary, an assistant, or a coach. Now, some things you can't delegate, making a crucial decision like what investment to make or who to marry or what job to take. You can't hire someone to do that for you, but you can still get assistance in terms of talking it through and gathering information.
You know, one of the most illuminating things for me in the book was that in the world of ADD, there are only two times, now and not now.
Yeah, that's my, I made that up a few years ago, but there really are two times. There's now and not now. And so you say, well, we're having an exam next Wednesday. And you say, well, not now. And then it's just gone. And so the function of anticipation does not come as naturally to folks with ADD as it does to someone else.
So that's the issue of that anticipation is part of that executive function.
Exactly.
So one of my compensatory mechanisms with this is to try to do everything when I think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't always do that because then that runs headlong into the other issue with ADD, and that's the difficulty in prioritizing.
Mm-hmm.
So that one compensatory mechanism actually interferes with another issue.
Right. But I think it's still a good one to have as your guiding principle. Do it now. I use that, and obviously the times when you can't do it now, but if you have that be, sort of your default position, and then you revise it if you're in a situation where you can't do it now, you're better off. Because for most folks with ADD, their default position is do it later.
That's exactly true.
So I think you're smart to have basically say to yourself, do it now unless I can't.
Right.
And the corollary is watch out for developing piles. You just sort of toss something into a pile.
Yeah, you talk about handle it once.
Yeah, so the Ohio, only handle it once. That's another wonderful acronym for You know, when you have a document, a piece of paper, you know, a memo, a magazine, a letter, a bill, try to either act on it, you know, pay the bill or throw it away, you know, in the case of a magazine or a journal or something, or read it and then throw it away, or put it in a labeled file or a proper storing place, but not a pile, because these piles become, you know, they're almost like metastatic cancer, you know, they spread everywhere. You know, you can get buried under your piles.
You know, I wonder if we could go back to a minute about diagnosis. You know, every time I tell someone I have ADD, they say, oh, I have it too. Kind of that modern life thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know that I do have ADD. I mean,
right.
I have enough training and I know how it's, you know, I know how it's made huge swaths of my life very dysfunctional until I learned how to compensate
right.
for them. So, and I know it can't be as common as it would seem from the reactions I get. So how do you separate the wheat from the chaff on this?
Well, you first of all realize that modern life does indeed mimic ADD, and it is worthy of intervention in its own right. So the fact that someone says, well, it's not real ADD, so what? You know, if you have these issues and they're getting in your way, you could benefit from professional help as much as someone with the true ADD. But the way you separate the true ADD from the sort of the overbooked, overstretched, and about to snap phenomenon that is becoming extremely common is history. If this has persisted your whole life, if it's present in all environments, in all situations, then it's true ADD. On the other hand, the severe case of modern life, that is environmentally dependent. It, you know, the symptoms go away when you go on vacation to a farm in Vermont. But true ADD, you go to a farm in Vermont and you turn the farm into an amusement park. So, you know, that one is in entirely environmentally induced and is of recent onset, i.e. as you got busier, whereas the other has been present pretty much your whole life. And while it is environmentally influenced, it's not environmentally caused.
And what would you say to the many folks out there who really don't understand it, whose attitude is kind of like, just, you know, get it together.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you just get yourself organized?
Mm-hmm.
How can someone explain themselves to them without having it sound as if they're just looking for a crutch or an excuse?
Yeah, well, you know, you can say, I understand what you mean because this all comes easily to you. But would you tell someone who was nearsighted to just squint harder? You know, I can see. Why can't you just do it? You know, and you say this is an invisible condition. You know, because you can't see the wiring in my brain, but my brain operates differently from yours. And you can say, and I love it. I'm not making any excuses. I love the fact that I'm more creative than the average person. I love the fact that I'm more intuitive than the average person. But the price I pay for that is I'm lousy at time management. I'm lousy at staying focused on boring tasks. I'm lousy at prioritizing. And so, you know, I need help with that. That's not an excuse, but it is an explanation. And that's an important point. You know, this diagnosis is not an excuse to get out of taking responsibility. It is, however, an explanation for why doing certain tasks is more difficult, and therefore you need to get help so that you can take responsibility more effectively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a similar reaction people had not too long ago to depression, where they'd say to someone who's depressed, oh, come on, suck it up. You know, life is hard. We all have to deal with adversity. And they didn't realize that, again, depression is a medical entity in its own right, and that for some people, sucking it up is a whole lot harder than it is for others, you know, but for biochemical reasons. And, you know, thank God we don't now sort of condemn people who are depressed and call them weak, as we did only a generation ago. I mean, the treatment for virtually everything in the realm of the mind until fairly recently was try harder, whether it was depression or anxiety or ADD or dyslexia or schizophrenia, for that matter, and if trying harder to shape up, you know, and if that didn't work, you were put in a prison called an asylum.
And actually, I think most people who have ADD, even if they're failing at many things in their lives, are tremendously courageous and have made a tremendously creative ways of compensating for things. It's just that much more difficult for them.
Absolutely. They tend to be very persistent, tenacious, not excuse-making kinds of people. Heroic. I just finished writing a book called Positively ADD, and I wrote it with a wonderful woman by the name of Catherine Corman, who used to be a professor of history at Harvard, and now she's an at-home mom, has triplets, and they all have ADD. And so she wanted to write a book for them about successful, happy adults with ADD, and we teamed up and we've just finished it. But it's proof positive that this is a condition that can, if you work at it right, can become a gift rather than a curse.
I'd like to move now on to some of the family dynamics and some of the psychological issues you talked about. You already mentioned the shame, which I think is probably really key to this. I know it has been in my life, just the shame you feel because you miss appointments, very simply, can be in itself something when you find yourself having to apologize. So you recommend cognitive behavioral therapy and mm-hmm. learned optimism. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could put that into context for us here.
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is just a term for a very common treatment for anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorders, learning how to think differently. And it really goes back a long way. There's a wonderful Roman philosopher named Epictetus who pretty much fathered the field. Most people think it was a 20th century invention, but if you read Epictetus, you can see cognitive therapy. And his central position is, and he discovered this or invented this when he was a slave. He was a Roman slave and, you know, horribly treated every day. And he said, I can't control my environment. I can't control what people are doing to me. But what I can control, what I can regulate, is what I think, how I respond. And so he developed the discipline of monitoring, regulating his own thoughts. And he did it so well, by the way, that his owner freed him, and his sayings were collected and put into a book, and Roman soldiers used to carry it with them when they went into battle. Variations on that can help all of us, just simply learning how to think positively, think constructively. Learned optimism is a term that Martin Seligman coined, and he's a psychologist at Penn. And optimism itself, it doesn't mean simply that you look on the bright side. It's much more muscular than that. It means, by my definition, that you take an approach that says there's no problem life can throw at me that I can't find a way to tackle or get the help that I need to tackle. And that's a wonderful, if you can instill that in people, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, even in your approach of looking at the strengths.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right, in with that. And then finally, families. You have some suggestions about working in families with this. What can partners and parents do to be supportive without enabling?
Well, watch out for that term enabling, because it really has led to a lot of mistakes in ADD. A lot of parents and teachers, for that matter, think, you know, well, you're 16 years old, you should be able to do this by now. And so they think, and I'll be enabling you if I remind you to do things. And that's just wrong. The fact of the matter is people with ADD never get as good at it as other people. And it's not enabling, it's helping them. It's not like an alcoholic where you're turning, looking the other way as they continue to drink. It's someone who needs help, you know, and you don't suddenly say, well, now you're 16, I'm going to withdraw that help, sort of by some arbitrary chronology that says at 16 you don't get help anymore. But the fact is they ought to continue to get the support, and there's no rule that says you can't get support for the rest of your life. I don't know anyone who doesn't get support. The name of the game in life is to learn how to be effectively interdependent, not to be independent. That's another one of these myths that we've promulgated, that somehow or other independence is the goal. No one is independent. We're all dependent in various ways. I'm dependent on the man who sells me groceries. You know, other people are dependent on me for the help I give them. So, you know, the name of the game in life is to learn how to be effectively interdependent. You don't want to become a leech or a burden, but to hold up independence as a goal leads people down a lot of very dangerous paths.
Dr. Edward Hollowell, or Ned. Francesca spoke with him in 2006 about his book, Delivered from Distraction. His latest, Super Parenting for ADD, came out in 2008.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.